Hello, I'm Phoebe White from the U.S. Rate Strategy Team at J.P. Morgan. You're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. I'm here with Alex Rover, Matt Josoff, Brian Yee, Jay Barry, and Eric Beinstein, strategists across our fixed income team, to discuss the market volatility observed over recent days in response to the spread of COVID-19 outside of China. Mike Feroli, our chief U.S. economist, said in a note yesterday that the behavioral responses could severely depress services consumption on things like travel, tourism, and group entertainment, and he now looks for U.S. growth of just 0.5% in the first half of this year, followed by a rebound in the second half. This morning, following a G7 conference call, the Fed came out and cut rates by 50 basis points after the RBA cut rates last night, and other central banks are expected to follow. I want to talk about what this means for various markets, how bank balance sheets are likely to handle the move to lower rates, and the impacts for funding markets. But Jay, let's start with the Treasury yield curve. We're at historic lows in intermediate and long-end rates right now. I mean, we have 10-year yields trading below 1%. How much lower do you think yields can go from here?
Thanks, Phoebe. It's been quite a move today. And I think the market's reacted as severely as it has for two reasons. First, the Fed and Chair Powell in his post-statement press conference did make the case that monetary policy is in fact not a panacea for the COVID-19 virus. Second, I think because the Fed did move in an intermediate basis, and this is so unusual, markets are looking at how the Fed has reacted in previous instances and where it's eased on an intermediate basis. And we've got six of these instances in the prior 22 years. Once in 1998 around the Russian default and the LTCM crisis, three times in 2001 during the tech bubble related recession and the September 11th events, and then twice in 2008. In each of those instances, the Fed has followed up an intermeeting ease with another ease at its next meeting, and that's what we're forecasting for March 18th. But interestingly, in five of those six episodes, the Fed has followed its ease on an intermeeting basis with an ease of the same magnitude at the next meeting. So it raises the likelihood that the Fed actually lowers rates by 50 basis points at the next meeting in 2 weeks' time. And that seems to be what the market's pricing in right now. And if we look at how markets have behaved in the past around these instances, it's clear that there's no real discernible pattern in outright Treasury yields, but the more powerful response is that the yield curve tends to steepen. And that's what we've seen, in fact, today.
And actually now, we've steepened almost 20 basis points in twos, tens over the past week. So how much steeper do you think the curve can go from here?
Sure. So looking at those other instances in which this has occurred, the yield curve has steepened on average by close to 25 basis points in the weeks following an intermeeting ease. So if we are running the risk of more aggressive action at the March meeting, and we think that's important simply because of the historical experience of how the Fed's behaved in the past. In 2008, once the Fed lowered rates to 1%, it followed it with a 75 basis point cut down to 25 basis points thereafter. If the Fed moves more aggressively in March and then moves more aggressively after that, it makes the case, combined with the historic experience we've seen, that the curve should steepen further from here.
Yep. And what about the flip side? I mean, Powell was asked this in the press conference today, didn't give a lot of guidance on it, but what if the impact of the virus is not as severe as we're fearing? Do you think that markets could price a reversal of those cuts anytime soon?
I think the bar is very high for the market to price in a reversal of these cuts, mainly because it's very clear, we think, that the Fed is moving towards an average inflation targeting framework in which it's tolerant, if not welcoming, of inflation that's above its 2% target. So already, core PCE is still below the Fed's 2% target right now. And if growth is going to run below trend for the first half of the year, the risk is that inflation decelerates from current levels, not accelerates. So we think the bar is pretty high for the Fed to reverse those cuts, and even higher for the market sort of to price this in, particularly because of how we're thinking about the Fed's reaction function with respect to inflation expectations. If we look at this expected shift in policy framework, it's really being predicated on the fact that it has to anchor inflation expectations to have a better chance of hitting its 2% inflation target. With these moves that we've seen over the past week, market implied inflation expectations are basically sitting at the lowest levels of the last 10 years, if not historic lows. So unless you see a material rise in TIPS breakevens or other measures of market-based inflation expectations, we think the bar is really high to consider the Fed to reverse course with these cuts over a short period of time.
Right. So I just want to touch on another dynamic. If we start to see a backup in yield, it seems like there's a lot of latent demand out there. Matt, you recorded a podcast earlier this week discussing convexity hedging flows and how offsides bank balance sheets are currently. We can include a link to that podcast with this one, but can you talk about some of your conclusions there?
Yeah, sure, Phoebe. Just in a nutshell, we think that a little over a year ago, there was a broad-based expectation that the Fed was going to be hiking multiple times. And you could see that in the forwards. And we think investors, particularly banks, were positioned for this. So they were leaning a little bit on the short side. What did we actually get delivered? We got cuts, not hikes. And what that meant was we ended up having more than 150 basis point rally. And banks in particular were impacted by this because both their assets and liabilities are negatively convex. The mortgage side, clearly, and the deposit side. And when you put those together, their duration gap got worse and worse and worse. We have evidence of that being the case because we can see their own NII forecast that show that they were benefiting from higher and higher rates, and that was getting more and more sensitive. We could see it in their AFS portfolio durations that we backed out. So it's clear that the duration gap was getting worse, and our derivative strategists have modeled this and estimated that the actual gap was something like a trillion 10-year equivalents. It's even more than that now. So this is a big, big number. And what does it ultimately mean? Well, I think this is a little different than 2003, where the GSEs were the big convexity hedgers. And the difference is, I think, that the GSEs recorded or reported their duration gap every month. And they were under a lot of pressure from their regulator to kind of eliminate that gap. And so there was immediate convexity hedging as a result. When you look this time around with the banks, it's not like the banks actually need to solve this problem immediately, but it's clearly creating a duration of equity problem that they need to fix. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be chasing the rally, but it means that I think sell-offs will probably be bought. And there's this latent demand, as you kind of referred to it, in the background. I think the other thing just to worth noting really quick is that there's not a lot of duration for banks to buy out there. So when you look at the three big sectors, treasuries have no spread, corporates, too much capital, mortgages, no duration. And just in a nutshell, mortgages used to make up 40%+ of the dollar duration of the fixed income market. That number is now sub 10%. So there's no duration left in the mortgage market. And this is a particularly challenging time, I think, for banks.
So speaking of mortgages, Brian, let's turn to you. How is your market performing through all of this volatility?
It's been pretty rough for us. I think the actual spread widening was relatively contained. I think year to date, well, excluding today's performance, which we'll see, when everything settles down, close it out. I think we're about 10 to 11 basis points wider year to date nominally. One thing about agency MBS is that now it has basically no duration. So the entire mortgage index has duration of about 2 years. And so if you translate that widening, you're talking about 10 to 12 ticks. And today, with the rates market doing what it did, we're certainly going to be a little bit worse than that. I think the agency MBS, in my view, has a fairly attractive valuations at this point. We're talking about adjustable volatility. The index offers about 50 basis points over treasuries. And if you don't adjust that, it's about 100 basis points. In a world where the 10-year is under 1%, you get 100 basis points for a relatively high-quality asset. But our issue now, and as we've been dealing with for the past year and a half now, is the refinancing wave that is going on and is relentless. It started affecting 4% coupons down to 3.5s and down to 3s. And if we keep going, even the 2.5s may get in the picture. So right now, about 80% or so of the mortgage universe are refinanceable, readily refinanceable. The only thing that's keeping it all going at once is the capacity issue. Banks still need to close the loans. And we are hearing certain large banks actually posting higher rates week on week because they got their hands full. But over time, this will ease, and which means that the steady forward origination sales will continue. And also going into the next month or two, you have purchase demand seasonally going up as well. And those purchase demand, especially, they are more likely to translate into net supply, which is a more sort of pressure cooker thing for our investor base. So we are concerned about supply seasonals. We are concerned about immediate growth supply as rates fall. We're also concerned about vol. So despite the fact that on paper, we look attractive spread-wise historically, The supply issue is keeping us hold off for now. And there is also great uncertainty with respect to how refinanceable, what the actual prepayment prints investors will get 2 months from now, 3 months from now, because of lag time in between low rates and the actual realized prepayments. And so because of that, we are overall relatively neutral at this point. I think that investors can ride this out. Supply will keep us from meaningfully tightening in spreads for some time. And I'll stop at that.
Great. Thank you. So, Alex, let's turn to the very front end of the curve. What are the implications for repo markets through all of these developments?
Yeah, there's a lot going on with cash, given all the volatility that we're seeing in markets. You know, one of the things we had noted, given the sudden and dramatic moves in equity prices, was we were seeing a lot more cash move into retail money market funds. And a lot of that we think was coming out of the equity markets and just sort of looking for a safe place. So that left money market funds with more money to try to deploy across the money market space. And we have seen a lot more of that sort of trying to go into bills, just trying to lock in relatively higher yields in anticipation of getting an ease like we did today. One of the consequences of that also was we were seeing sort of money funds commit less into repo over the past few weeks. So there was sort of less cash coming into the repo markets. And on the other side of the repo markets, where you have dealers who are trying to finance positions, a lot of the violence that we've seen in the rate moves the past few weeks, I think, have led to an unwinding of a number of, say, the Treasury futures basis trades. So consequently, you know, we're seeing dealers wind up with more Treasuries on their inventories to finance. At the same time, we're also seeing, you know, pretty significant buying and selling activity out of sort of momentum-based Treasury investors. Long story short, it feels like locally the dealers have more Treasury collateral that they need to finance. They're not necessarily seeing as much cash coming from the money market community to finance that. And so we, you know, come into today where we have the Fed offering their overnight temporary operation. And it was oversubscribed for the first time since October. So I don't think we're necessarily going back to the market stress that we had last fall. However, the message I think you take away from the oversubscribed TOMO is that, you know, it might be useful for the Fed to increase the size of their overnight operations, at least on a temporary basis, while this volatility plays out.
Do you expect that to happen soon?
It would probably be best if they did it sooner rather than later.
All right, last but not least, let's turn to the credit markets. Eric, how have all these developments impacted your views on high-grade bond spreads?
So it's interesting because the changes that we've made at JP Morgan is, of course, lower rates, but only modestly lower growth. And when we look at credit spreads in high-grade, we see over the medium term, you know, growth at 1.4 versus 1.7. That doesn't change my view on spreads. And there's really been no correlation between rates and credit spreads over the medium term as well. So I haven't adjusted my year-end spread target. That said, you know, as the risks are growing about broader impact on economic growth, it does bias us a little bit wider. But, you know, we also remember or look at what's going on in Europe, where rates are much lower and spreads are lower as well. So we could see a dynamic where this search for yield and for duration actually creates more demand for credit as there's less and less yield in other asset classes.
And what are you seeing on the technical side?
So very interesting. In high-grade credit, we had no bond issuance last week. On Monday this week, we didn't have any as well. And then today, on Tuesday, some issuers tested the waters and came to market. So you know, we tend to get $4 to $5 billion of supply every day. And so to go for 6 days with no supply is clearly a positive for the technical situation. And also, the fund flow data that we're able to monitor shows steady inflows into high-grade bond funds. And so with lack of supply plus these inflows, cash should be building among fund managers.
So what if the virus continues to spread? Which sectors do you think will be the most impacted?
Well, I mean, the most obvious negative answer on that is anything related to hospitality and travel. That's more of a high-yield space than high-grade. So there's two sectors that we're focused on. One is energy. Energy is by far the sector that's most sensitive to economic growth overall and to global economic growth. And energy has been the larger underperforming sector so far. And if we continue to sort of revise global growth numbers down, I think that's going to continue. And then directly related to rates are the financials, you know, banks and insurance. Large U.S. banks have multi sources of revenue, but net interest margin is going to be pressured. And the insurance industry over the long term relies on investing their premium into long duration assets and yield. And they're really the ones who over time are going to suffer if we are now structurally in a lower yielding environment.
Okay. And, you know, with all the focus on the virus and the policy responses to that, some might forget that today is actually Super Tuesday. You recently published an in-depth note talking about the sector-by-sector impacts of some of the policy proposals there. But can you talk about some of the takeaways from that?
Yes. You know, the format of our note was not look at the candidates, but to look at the policies that are being proposed. Because as we narrow down the candidate list, we think it's these policies that are going to start to form the platforms from the Democratic side. And you know, Trump as well will and has continued to talk about his priorities. And so there's a few areas that are getting a lot of focus. One is environmental regulation, particularly fracking. Across the Democratic candidates, there's a range of policies from a goal to ban all fracking to banning fracking on federal lands, things like that. Those would be quite negative, of course, for the companies involved in that industry, but also potentially pushing up energy prices here and globally. And so there's, well, not maybe not base case, certainly some tail risk issues for the energy space we're watching. Healthcare is the one that people focus on the most. But one of the things that we highlight in our note is that some of the radical or aggressive transformations that are being talked about require congressional approval. And this, at least looking at the current state of U.S. politics, we think is a pretty low-risk outcome. And also there's calls for changes to the tax code and perhaps an unwinding of the Tax Reform Act of 2018. Again, very difficult to implement without a clear mandate across both houses of Congress. So we think investors should focus on the regulatory areas where things can be implemented, perhaps pipeline approvals, bank regulation. There are things that we're watching, but you know, the tail risk scenarios require a strong political consensus that we may not get in the next few months.
Thanks, Eric. And thanks, everyone, for joining. Institutional clients can find more on these topics on JP Morgan Markets at jpmm.com or reaching out directly with questions. Stay tuned for more episodes of, At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020, JP Morgan Chase & Co., all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 3rd, 2020.